And the magic of technology works here, right? I shouldn't say that.
I'm sitting here holding my breath. Wonderful. Okay. Okay, good morning. Ann said, my name is Shelby Chartkoff, and I'm from Grand Valley State University. I'm presenting this work on behalf of myself and my colleagues, Becky Twing, who helped with a lot of cleaning up of the data involved, Leanne Roman, who's in the audience, and I'm presenting on behalf of her too, who's the head of the Michigan Families Medicaid Project for the state at Michigan State University, and Chris Magia, who is also involved with the project. And I have no financial relationships to disclose. If anyone knows of any financial relationships involved in this work, please let me know. I'd like to have some. We're now living in this age of data, and data has been slower to come by in mass quantities in some aspects for maternal child health in terms of building those large integrated databases that we can really draw on to look at health outcomes. But this is a phenomenon that's happening around us in a lot of areas and is starting to really start to come into play with maternal child health as well. And more states and communities are interested and are actively building the kinds of data infrastructure and data linkages that are needed in order to make better use of the untapped information in all of the health records, health outcomes, health risk data that is available out there. As part of this new extension of the information age, where we're talking about the gigabyte age of data, or the petabyte age of data, new technologies and methodologies are emerging for analyzing these very, very large data sets, and they're emerging at a rapid pace. And so the question with the methodological motivation for this work is, you know, can we tap these tools and these data sets for the benefit of public health and for maternal child health in particular, for being able to better serve women and infants. From the practical standpoint of the maternal health field, we're facing, as probably everyone in this room knows, increasing limitations on public funding and particularly strains on how far our Medicaid dollars can stretch, as well as an awareness that neither budgets nor the best clinical and community practice knowledge serves a one-size-fits-all solution. Our moms are too complex, their health is too complex, and we've got a diverse population of women to serve. And so there's a need to be able to understand and craft tailored interventions for those women and the complexities of their health. And these problems are only expected to increase as we're sort of looking at particularly the economy nowadays and these increasing income inequalities with more women potentially in need of support and the needs that they're presenting in many cases growing more acute based on those financial and community strains. And so that means that our interventions will need to become more strategic in order to make the most use of the resources that we have and to best serve the complex needs of our women. So the bottom line is that all of this requires a refined sense of the ways in which the multiple factors interact to produce poor birth outcomes and an enhanced ability to predict these outcomes so that interventions can be applied in targeted ways to our population. What comes into play here for this work is that we can benefit from, in Michigan, the Maternal Child Linked Data Warehouse, which is a data source that's housed at the Michigan Department of Community Health and that brings together Medicaid claims data, including all health services counts and, you know, service dates, claim amounts, costs for all health services for Medicaid-eligible, Medicaid-insured women, pregnant women, as well as maternal support services claims for the Enhanced Prenatal Services Program for the state, as well as vital records data, including linked infant birth and death certificate data, and finally WIC data for the Women, Infants, and Children's Program, including screening information that is gathered from women at the time of their enrollment in WIC and service information from that program. What we can bring now to this data set and what we've begun to experiment with and work with are classification models that we can use to draw on this very rich data source to start to build models to be able to better identify complex interaction patterns that predict poor birth outcomes, as well as to create good models to really start to accurately predict who is at risk for having a poor birth outcome. The general approach to classification looks something like this here, where you start with your data set and the variable selection choices that you make from that. So for a complex data set like the maternal child health warehouse, there's a lot of fields, and so there's the content domain knowledge that goes into selecting which fields are we going to model, how are we going to code them in order to build the best and most understandable combination of predictors for our data. From there, we build a training combination of training sets and test sets. The training set is what you learn, what the model learns from. And involved in that are making some choices in terms of what kind of model you're going to build and what that algorithm is going to be. And then we apply the model, test it, take a look at what we've got, and again, kind of go around with this sort of iterative process of refining and building these models to take a look at what's going on. Classification trees are a particular type of algorithm, or family of algorithms, and the basis of classification is really coming up with what are the combination of predictors in a branching approach that gets you towards the cleanest distinctions between one result and the other. In this case, variations of poor birth outcome versus not poor birth outcome. Does anyone here use email? Yeah. Does anyone here use a spam filter related to your email or have one built in? Okay. So how a spam filter works, that's the same, it's the same concept. You know, the spam filter learns how to, as best it can, how to distinguish between spam and not spam. And does it always get it right? No. But, you know, as those models build up, as you're training your model by telling it what's spam and what's not spam, it gets more accurate over time. That's the same basic principle, is creating these criteria to try to understand what are the splits that give us different combinations of poor birth outcome versus not poor birth outcome. To build this, the combination of factors that we've settled on so far include a combination of predicted outcomes, where we've been looking at low birth weight, preterm delivery, and neonatal intensive care unit admissions. And these models, while we've done some work for simplicity's sake looking at combined outcomes for that, they're more accurate when they're separated. Even though there's a lot of overlap amongst these outcomes, the specific pathways are somewhat different for each one. So we're going to take a look at some of these. For the demographic factors that we've included, includes race, age grouping, education level, which Medicaid program the mom was enrolled in, and that really is for us as a proxy measure of income and what level of poverty. So moms who were enrolled in Program C, which corresponds with having been eligible for AIDS with assistance for families with dependent children, those are the poorest of the poor in terms of our population, versus women who became eligible for Medicaid by virtue of becoming pregnant, which is a more lax set of requirements. All these women are obviously low income. Some are more low income than others. We've looked to include migrant status and as well as an indicator of how urban or rural the county in which the mom lived is. For behavioral risks, we looked at smoking, alcohol use, and drug use, and this kind of was a combination of any sort of indication of these risk factors across the data set. So whether it was reported in the WIC data, the vital records data, the Medicaid claims data, we looked for those indicators of whether that behavioral risk was in play. And as well as psychosocial risks, including whether or not there was a father named on the birth record, a depression diagnosis for the claims data, and the timing of prenatal care initiation. I'll note that we ended up settling with timing of prenatal care initiation as opposed to more traditional measures of prenatal care adequacy, because in the end, prenatal care adequacy tended to fall out of our models pretty quickly, whereas timing of initiation has consistently been able to show a role for that. So in our mind, that may be more of an indicator of psychosocial stress or some other things going on with those mothers that's causing them to delay their entry into prenatal care. We've looked at pregnancy and birth history, as well as a series of chronic and disease risks. So all of these we've been able to feed into these algorithms to take a look at what's going on. And we've approached this looking both descriptively in terms of can we gain new insights into the groups of women at higher risk and potentially identify pathways that seem to produce significant differences in outcomes. As well as other approaches. So here's an example of what one of our descriptive pathways has looked like, and this is looking at combined birth outcomes, and you can see that it gets quite complex. Part of the complexity has to do with the fact that there's both, this is a combined look at whether there was any poor birth outcome, including preterm labor, low birth weight, and NICU admission. But what we can see here by looking at this, one of the things we can see quite readily is, first off, that race is no surprise, I think, to a lot of us, based on what we show in the literature and in our data all the time, that race is the single biggest splitting factor when you look at these descriptive versions of these models here, and that there's different pathways for black women versus women of other races. So, for example, if we follow this, we can see that for black women, the groups that were at the absolute highest risk and shockingly high risk for a poor birth outcome among our Medicaid population in Michigan were those who entered prenatal care at the third trimester or did not enter prenatal care at all, who were either over 35 or drug users. And as well as, not very far behind, those who had received prenatal care earlier than the third trimester, but showed indications of or had reported hypertension in their records. So we're able to see some of these more complicated potential pathways that can initiate and inspire questions that we can take back to our policymakers, we can take back to public health providers in our communities to explore what kinds of potential interventions can make a difference with these subsets of our population. And for non-black women, again, there's similar themes that appear, but in different order, in different ways. And so there's different pathways that seem to be involved. These are not prescriptive pathways. This is not the only way that this data could be modeled, but it gives a sense in terms of how creating a typology of risk and different levels of risk that can inform other work. If we look strictly at low birth weight, the model looks a lot simpler. in terms of a lot of the other variables seem to have fallen out as not as specifically important to this group. And we see that, again, race matters, smoking matters, but for our non-black women, that the difference factors, drug use again comes into play, and then hypertension again comes into play. So, you know, this concurs with some recent work that's really highlighting the role of hypertension in producing low birth weight outcomes. So when we search for predictive value in these models, one of the things that we find is that while these simple single trees are really interesting for exploration and for identifying new patterns to pursue, they're not the best predictors of new cases unknown to the original model. So these models, they train on one model and they're informative, but they're not stellar at taking unseen cases and being able to accurately classify that. For that, we use smarter learners. And one of the approaches for doing this is to use what are called ensemble methods, which basically build a bunch of models and use various techniques to combine them to come up with the smartest possible model for being able to predict this. The most accurate collective estimate. For our purposes, we've used algorithms called AdaBoost, which has shown good accuracy in a lot of other instances, and which outperform the other classifiers that we use in our experiments with this data. And what AdaBoost does is it gets smarter over iterations. So it starts out, and it runs a kind of similar tree model to what I showed you before. And then it looks at the women that it predicted correctly in its test set and the women that it didn't predict correctly. And it takes that and it looks at how overall accurate that model was, and it gives it a weight based on that. And then it looks at the women it didn't predict correctly, and it says, I think we can do better with you. And it reweights the data set to emphasize those women, and then runs the model again. And then it does it again and again until you reach convergence. And so in your prediction, it adds up these weighted scores from all the underlying models to produce a final class probability estimate. And what we found is that so far with our, for example, for our low birth weight outcome, we've gotten models that now are about 75% accurate. And that pick up about 80% of unseen low birth weight cases. So we're getting there. We're working on this. We're getting close. For our next steps, we need to refine and explore these models, bring in some new years of data, develop profiles of these combinations of risk factors to produce this, and explore better visual approaches to display and convey some of the interactions of these factors, as well as to look at some aspects that seem to have a really strong impact on the accuracy of the model, but are a little hard to suss out. One of them is our accuracy of the model has gone through the roof when we've included variables associated with the county. So there's obviously something locally that's going on, or some clustering at the county level, and it's going to take a lot of additional work to sort of figure out what that is. We're also going to be benefiting from the addition of new risk screener data from a risk screening program that the state is implementing as part of its revised policy. And our end goal is to provide information at multiple levels, both for policymakers to direct resources for better large-scale programming approaches, for the local communities to be able to see where women in their community are outperforming or underperforming the model based on characteristics that are just, you know, about them, to be able to tailor their own local interventions, as well as for local practitioners themselves to be able to feed in their assessment results of risk screeners and instantly get back, hopefully, some real-time or rapid feedback about what the risks are for the populations that they're working with. and I will be more than happy to take your questions. Thank you. Yes. Yes, there's several software packages that can work with these kinds of algorithms. The one that I've specifically used is called Weka, W-E-K-A. Weka, yeah, they're from New Zealand, so I think it's the name of a New Zealand bird. And it is open source, it is free. You can go online, you can download it today and start playing around. It's not easy, but it is available, and it's a tool that you can start using to explore some of these things. I use the statistical programming language R as a wrapper for Weka. It makes it a little bit easier to get the data in and then to manipulate the data and, you know, do things with it once it's out. But the driving engine would be Weka, and that has a desktop application. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So are there any kinds of factors you take into consideration about how important the given risk factor might be? Or it's sort of the idea of necessary but not sufficient. In other words, if you do not manage a person with hypertension well, no matter what you do otherwise, you may wind up with a bad baby.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
You know, I think that there are separate processes that need to be both accounted for. What the model does, and I think that there are ways that we could try to weight certain variables better, but what the model is really looking for is what is the best, you know, the model doesn't care about anything but how do I predict who's going to have a poor birth outcome. And, you know, and what do I need to do, and how do I need to weight the variables in order to best predict that? So that's what that's doing. There's lots of other, especially from a policy and programming standpoint, there's lots of other factors that one would want to consider in terms of, is this a modifiable risk? What does this risk mean in the context of our local practice and community? You know, some things you can do more about than others. Some things you can change and some things you can't. So that's where we're trying to bring together both the purely predictive, smart model approach, as well as some of these more descriptive aspects that I think are better at potentially driving good conversations around that. You know, these are conversations that a wonk in an office with highfalutin statistics doesn't need to approach. It's something that we need to be talking about with our local public health practitioners. So, thanks.
We'll hopefully have some additional time at the end. Let's see. Okay. Ooh.